So, good afternoon. Let me begin. So, today is the last lecture in this series. I very much hope that you got something out of my lectures. And next three lectures will be by David, who will talk about momentum space, RG, and other things. So, yesterday I was doing some real space RG in some detail, both 1D and 2D. In passing, I pointed out one of the popular transformations called bond moving approximation, where you start with the partition function expression, and then in an ad hoc fashion, say that I remove this bond. So I replace it here, so j becomes 2j. Similarly, I remove this bond, j becomes 2j, and so on. So to begin with, I do one operation. Similarly, I move bonds from here. So at the end of the day, every bond becomes 2j, except that there is a new spin here. And then this spin that was there is hanging. It's not coupled to anybody, so I can integrate it over. Then the decimation that we did before amounted to integrating over these spins in sublattice A, let us say. This is something that we can easily do. So I pointed out that when you do this, you generate, after this bond moving, essentially nearest neighbor coupling in the new lattice. So you don't have further coupling. So by this ad hoc procedure, you remain within the same subspace. You start with the nearest neighbor and get nearest neighbor again. So the procedure, as I said, looks ad hoc but from the point of view of block spin formulation, in some sense, when I look at the things from distance, I cannot distinguish between interaction between this spin and this spin, and because they're very strongly correlated. So I might as well call this cluster and define a new coupling. That's the whole idea behind. And as I said, it can be rationalized using Kernow's variational approach and so on. But I thought I would just point out one extra thing, which is very nice in the sense, previously when I decimated a one-dimensional problem, so the coupling J and J tan hyperbolic J prime, that is the coupling that I get after one decimation, is equal to tan hyperbolic square j. You remember this is how we got, because basically we got cos j, or 1 plus spin 1, 2, 3, spin 1, spin 3, then 1 plus spin 2, spin 3. Then you integrate over spin 2. Then you get many terms vanish. That is, you integrate over spin 2. Then you get 1 plus tan hyperbolic square j, spin 1 and spin 3. So this is how we said that the original j gets renormalized to j square. So this is the recursion relation. You give me a value at one length scale, I will give you the value in the next length scale through this equation. Now, if you follow the same thing, and this, you remember, we had we solved this problem by the following thing. That is, if I plot the left-hand side, I have tan hyperbolic. And if I plot the right-hand side, it is square. So it starts deviating like this. Sorry? Yes, exactly. Asymptotically, they will approach each other. Correct. Now, when you do this problem, now just one modification, and namely tan hyperbolic j prime is equal to tan hyperbolic square 2j. This is the only modification. It turns out this simple modification already gives us phase transition in two dimensions. How do we see that? Now, if you do the same thing as we previously, what did we do? We said that start from a point, then renormalization amounts to finding the corresponding value here, and then so we went. So the renormalization procedure took us at every step to lower value. Then after infinite steps, you reach the fixed point which corresponds to J equal to 0 or infinite temperature. That means you start at any finite temperature. Things may be locally ordered, but at long distance, they are disordered. So renormalization procedures creates block spins. And effectively, you will go to a situation in which these blocks are uncorrelated. The size of the block is coherent, correlation length. So this is what we saw. Now, when you plot this curve, now with this modified argument, you will notice that basically the two curves, in addition to meeting at the origin, will also meet at a particular point here. And as before, if I start anywhere here, I will keep going down and then reach infinite fixed point. But on the other hand, if I start from here, then the procedure is, it amounts to starting from here, and then finding the corresponding value, and then I'll keep going out. So which already tells that what you have got here is a kind of unstable fixed point, which corresponds to a particular value of JC. So if you start from the neighborhood at a higher temperature, you will run to infinity, which corresponds to this. If you start from JC at the lower temperature, slightly lower temperature, you will run to ferromagnetic state, completely ordered state. So this simple, you know, change in recursion relation is already obtained in this bond moving approximation. So it captures the presence of phase transition plus non-trivial fixed points that we estimated in the last lecture. So this is what I just wanted to tell you. And as I also pointed out that these approximations give you good qualitative ideas about phenomena in lattice gauge theories, which are, in some sense, more complicated statistical mechanical problems. OK. Now I will go to finishing the partition function evaluation, which I started a couple of times, never finished. So the basic idea was to write down the two-dimensional partition function in terms of transfer matrices. This transfer matrix corresponds to identifying partition function of spins, let's say, in this particular column, and then spins from this column, and then basically identifying this quantity. Let me call it as a column I and I plus 1. And then along this, I have length. So this is like the x coordinate. This is like the y coordinate. So coupling among spins along the chain will be have the same x coordinate. So I have this. Then I have coupling between spin here and next one. That will be minus j. SL I. So this is a matrix. So if you can think about it as a matrix with all spins belonging to this column and all spin belong to this column. So this matrix is 2 to the power of n dimensional. So in one dimension, you had just n equal to 1. Because the transfer matrix generated just a 2x2 matrix. Here you have 2 to the power of, I had the notation m. So I have a m by m lattice. Number of sites, if I walk along the x direction is m and y direction is m. So m square is the total number of sites in the problem. So we have to diagonalize this. So Ansager and I think earlier Kramers and others, Vanier, set up a program in which they rewrote evaluation of partition function as finding out the largest eigenvalue of this big matrix, because using translation invariance and the definition of the, the problem of evaluating partition function amounts to taking the mth power of the operator and finding the trace, which amounts to the thermodynamic limit, finding the largest eigenvalue of this operator P, because that alone will dominate in the thermodynamic limit. So the whole aim is to find out the largest eigenvalue of this transfer matrix operator. So then I proceeded further and said that since we are focusing on this, you can remove the index I and I plus 1 and replace it by S belonging with an index S, S prime. And then in this set, the y-axis index is there. So then I further said, taking analogy from one dimension, that it can be rewritten in terms of new spin variable, because what I do is I had this original spin, then explicitly write down the matrix as I did for one dimension. Please recall that I wrote the matrix like this. And then I said that matrix can be written as identity times a Pauli matrix, tau identity times e to the power of j plus e to the power of minus j times tau x, because tau x is 0, 1. So it's a way of rewriting this 2x2 matrix in this language. Then I pointed out that when we come to our problem, which has a chain now, entire thing goes through, and effectively you get minus j, s. Instead of s, you have this tau matrix now. Because it is diagonal, you can just write it explicitly like this, tau I plus 1. The tau matrix becomes so that's what happens to the first term, because it has no prime. Then the term that has a prime can be written as theta tau ix, and there tan hyperbolic theta, there was an expression for theta, I will write it down. Now, what is important is, I did not explicitly point out, when you go from 2 to 2 to the power of n dimensional state that we are discussing, this tau, when I write tau I, this operator, it is supposed to mean an operator living in this 2n to the power of m dimensional vector space. So it should be understood as direct product of unit matrices, except at the site I, where you have this Pauli matrix Si x. This is the meaning of this. So originally I had only one site, now I have several sites. So when I write down this operator, it turns out this term contains unit operator corresponding to all the other degree of freedom. So in principle, I could have an operator which contains non-trivial Pauli component from many of these sites. So I could write down a big matrix. But what appears in our operator is a very simple matrix in which there is only one non-trivial entry. Everywhere else, it's unity. So it's a direct product. So this is the kind of thing that we do. In fact, when you talk about, let's say, n qubit system, and then when you write down operators that connect various qubits, this is the meaning. So you have implicitly an identity operator everywhere else. And then at the place where you are acting, you may have some instead of identity, you may have one of the three components of the Pauli operator or some combination. So it has to be understood in this particular sense. Okay. So this is what now we have to. So this is our transfer matrix. It's a big operator. The main problem in diagonalizing this problem is that they don't commute. Even if they commute, even if I make it, you know, like e to the power of a plus b, I have a non-trivial Hamiltonian living on a chain. And that it is in diagonalizing that Ansager spent several pages and went into Clifford algebra, quaternions, and so on, and managed to diagonalize this operator. And Liebschulz and Matisse diagonalized this using the Jordan-Wigner trick, so which is what I will complete today. And then from there, get the largest eigenvalue of this operator as an integral, a one-dimensional integral involving some angle. And there, the expression that you get, which is what Ansager got, is sufficiently complicated. But you can do some, you can identify the critical point just by looking at the expression, and then do some algebraic analysis and extract logarithmic singularity contained in the free energy, and also show that the specific key diverges logarithmically. So that's what I will do now. So let me focus on this first. Now, the way Jordan-Wigner transformation is defined in textbooks and conventionally, so it is it just demands us that we make a, just this is for convention. I could work with this, but it's better if I make a transformation in which I rotate about the y-axis and then write tau iz as tau ix. Similarly, tau ix as tau iz. So if I do that, let me call this v1, that is, it's exponential of v1. So v1 becomes minus j tau ix tau I plus y. And then v2, which is just this, becomes minus theta tau ix. Just renaming the labels as, instead of z and x, I call it as x and z, sorry. Okay, just this is some. Now, after this transformation, I can go back to the standard definition of fermion in terms of Jordan-Wigner variable and complete the calculation. So what I was pointing out was that you can construct a fermion operator out of this Pauli spin operator simply by by doing this. Which is tau I plus ladder operator. So that the anticommute can be shown explicitly by, so let me do it figuratively. What you do is you have a site I. So what you are interested in is the anticommutation relation of these two operators. These operators are defined by this equation. That is, what I do is I start from the beginning, site 1, take the product up to the site previous one to I, and then put the sigma plus operator, or tau plus operator, or tau minus operator. And then that will define C dagger and the Hermitian conjugate, which will involve tau I minus. Okay. So now I choose a site, which is here. So in terms of pictures, I have this site. And then if you look at this operator, it's as if there is a string going up to the boundary. So here, there is again a string. So what is an anticommutation relation? It says that I have Cj. Definition is Cj Ci dagger. This is what I have. So in order to find the final result, what I'll have to do is, for example, I'll have to take the Ci dagger and push it through. And then it should become, when I do that, it should become the same thing with the minus sign. It should vanish. So how do you get? So you can, for example, take this product. So I have tau 1. Yes? Plus. And then I have tau 1. So as I push through, everything will go through because the sites are different. Except when I push through, there will be one term which will start feeling this operator. So when I push that through, basically, I will have to say that tau, they actually commute and I get a minus one. Because that is the effect of this operation. And then that minus one will remain when I push the other things through and making this vanish. So it's a straightforward thing. Please do it and then you will get it. And it's interestingly, you can generalize it in two dimension also. Then what you will have a string, effectively, another string associated. So you, whenever you take this string through this, you will pick up a phase factor. It will make it anticommuting. It turns out you can generalize Jordan-Wigner transformation to two dimension. Then when you look at corresponding things in two dimension in the modern language, it will amount to attaching a flux to a particle. You know, learn in quantum mechanics that there is this famous Bohm-Bohr-Arnoux effect. That is, if I have a magnetic flux confined to a thin cylinder such that the magnetic field outside is zero, but there is a non-zero vector potential. If I go around, I will pick up a phase factor. Even though the magnetic field is zero, the vector potential is non-trivial. So I will pick up a phase factor which is related to the flux carried by this tube. So exactly in this construction, what I am doing is I am attaching a Z2 flux to this boson. This is like a boson. And then as they pass through, they give a minus one. In two dimension, similar thing happens. OK. Now the advantage, why am I doing this? When I do that, these operators become manageable and becomes just sum of free fermion operators. That is what we will do. Okay. So how do we see that? Okay. So let me look at this term. So I will write it as and then I substitute for tau I, which is in terms of, I also forgot to mention the inverse transformation that actually you can invert this relation and write tau I plus as Ci dagger exponential of I times pi L less than I. Similarly for tau minus. So this is very important. It's just directly invertible. So now it's very clear. Your fermion operator carries an exponential of a phase factor, which is like this Bohm-Bohr-Arnoux phase factor. What it does is it counts all the fermions on my left and then puts this number. So fermion number has to be 0 or 1. I mean, it has to be some integer. So essentially, because if it, depending on if the integer is even, you will have e to the power of I pi times an even number, which is 1. If it is odd, it will be minus 1. So the entire effect of this is just a plus or minus 1, but it depends on the detailed distribution of particles to my left. So it looks at one property, namely whether I have odd number of fermions or even number of fermions. That's it. But that is what, you know, makes, if you think about it, if this has anti-commutation relation, this tau will have commutation relation. So it converts boson into fermion and fermion into boson. So we, again, it's simple algebra that if you take this and substitute here, you will get all these phase factors will annihilate each other, except to give That is, it is this important minus sign which is coming from the phase factor, from the Jordan-Wigner tail. So this is what has happened to this. Then what happens to this tau I z term? That simply becomes 2 times ci dagger ci minus 1. So I have managed to write down objects which were in terms of Pauli spin operator, in terms of fermion operators, once I ordered the site along a chain. And then the z component has this form. Now what is interesting is, now once you look at this operator v1, becomes simply plus so I'm sure you have done quantum mechanics of particles hopping on a lattice. It could be bosons or fermion. So this is a problem of some fermions hopping on the one-dimensional lattice. It says that if there is a fermion at site I plus 1, it will be annihilated and put in the site I. That means there is a hopping. So there is a corresponding opposite process, which is Hermitian conjugate. But this is unusual. Normally, you don't come across this term when fermions are hopping. This says the fermion number is not indeed conserved. There is a possibility at a site, two neighboring sites, I and I plus 1, two fermions can spontaneously come from the vacuum. And if two fermions are present, they can spontaneously disappear. So this is an unusual Hamiltonian. You will come across this if you do superconductivity theory. Because in superconductivity theory, the so-called BCS mean field Hamiltonian has this form. Because in superconductivity, there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking in which Cooper pairs are formed, and they go into some kind of Bose-condensed state. So Bose-condensed state means they have macroscopic occupation. So the entire phenomenon of superconductivity amounts to saying that the interaction takes real particle, real fermions, a pair of them, and puts them in the condensate, and similarly takes them out that condensate. It's that process which leads to coherence and superconductivity. So for some strange reason, we have got some Hamiltonian operator which looks like superconducting Hamiltonian. But what is important for is, this is a solvable problem. In terms of taus, particularly when you in together, suppose you had this, there was no way of solving it by any elementary trick. Now I can solve it by doing Fourier transformation. This is a remarkable thing that happens in a translation invariant system. So when you do Fourier transformation, you define that, you say that ci dagger. Now I'm going to assume that in order to be able to do Fourier transformation, periodic boundary condition. But in practice, when the system is very large, even when you have an open chain, you can do Fourier transformation. The amount of mistakes you will be making when you calculate physical quantities will vanish as 1 over volume or 1 over chain size. In fact, this is a famous discussion that you often have in lattice dynamics in terms of von Karman periodic boundary condition. In reality, we don't have a periodic system. Things have boundaries. So when you consider a large system, you can pretend as if you have periodic boundary condition and do the analysis. But here there is a very important thing which I ignored. But again, it's unimportant in the thermodynamic limit. When I say periodic boundary condition, I take my two-dimensional lattice and let's say wrap it in the y direction. Okay, so that means my first site will meet my last site when I move around. So there is a term which corresponds to hopping of fermion from the site 1 to n. And if you follow through Jordan-Wigner transformation, there is one term, namely this term, because you define Jordan-Wigner transformation by starting with the initial site I, and then you construct chain operators. but everything will cancel except for this term, which connects the first and the nth psi, and then it will contain in basically e to the power of I 2 pi pi times total number of fermions in this system. So depending on whether I'm in the sector in which the total number of fermions is even or odd, I will have a minus or plus 1. So that means this hopping matrix element, everywhere it's minus, but at this junction, it can be plus or minus 1 depending on the total number of fermions available. So that makes the problem mathematically a little hard, but it turns out at the end of the day, even if you ignore this, the correction you make is insignificant. It vanishes 1 over some number of sites in the problem. So if you are rigorous, you solve the problem saying that I will solve the problem in 2 sectors, because I will solve the problem in even sector and also odd sector. In the odd sector, I will have a minus 1. Then in the even sector, I will have a plus 1. But we will not do that, because that requires a little more algebra. But I just wanted to point out that this is there. If I had an open chain, this Jordan-Wigner tail, this is simply not there, because I don't have hopping from 1 to 2. But then in an open chain, ideally, I cannot use Fourier modes, running modes. I will have to use standing waves. Then that leads to mathematical complications. But finally, everything is fine when the system becomes larger. The difference between periodic and antiperiodic boundary conditions become insignificant. OK. So now when I keeping this in mind, I Fourier transform this problem. Then when I do, I get the following. 2j. Yeah. So the Fourier transform is defined as e to the power of I k. A is some lattice parameter. L is the index. And then c. So I sum over all sites. I sum over all allowed values of k, then I have psi. Let me call it as L. So this is the definition of Fourier transformation. Just a standard Fourier transformation. I have this phase factor and I have this momentum mode. These are mode in real site, these are mode in k site. And as before, if you look at the allowed k values, the limit that the chain length becomes large, it becomes a quasi-continuum. It goes from minus pi by a to plus pi by a. That is, allowed values of this k in this periodic lattice is simply bounded by minus pi by a and plus pi by a, which is the well-known Brillouin zone. Okay. So this is when you have periodic structures. If you don't have a periodic structure, your Fourier, instead of Fourier series, you'll have Fourier transformation going from minus infinity to plus infinity. We are dealing with periodic systems, and we are dealing with discrete lattice. So this is something important. So when you take this definition and put it here, and then when you sum over these i's, basically you will get a cosine how does the cosine come? Because when I take this L dagger and L plus 1, then I will have e to the power of I k a L coming from the first term, then e to the power of minus I k prime a L plus 1 coming from the second term. Now, here I will have c k, for example, and c k prime. Then when I sum over L, I get a delta function, because it is e to the power of I k minus k prime a times L. This is the definition of delta function, because unless k equal to k prime, the phases will interfere and will give you 0 for any difference k minus k prime. So basically, this becomes a Kronecker delta function times m. M is the number of sites. These are all elementary things that which you know. So using that, you get as it should be, because you have a translation invariant system. It should conserve momentum or wave vector. That is, you create a particle at wave vector k, you can only put it in the same way vector. Suppose for some reason you had inhomogeneous spin-spin couplings. In other words, there is no translation invariance. Then when you do this, in general, you will get some CK, CK prime, saying that momentum is not conserved, and there will be some epsilon K, K prime. Fortunately, we don't have this situation. We have a translation invariant system in which momentum is conserved, and this is the first term in V1. And the second term, you follow the same procedure, will be sin KA times plus Hermitian conjugate. Here again, it's it conserves momentum. It says that spontaneously two particles can come out, but the net momentum better be zero because I have a translation invariant system. So here also, the momentum transfer is zero when I just count the number of particles. So this is a Hamiltonian. Yes. So exactly minus k. So pair of fermions with opposite momentum come out of the vacuum, and pair of fermions with opposite momentum can disappear into the vacuum. Okay, this under V2 is simple again. Now I observe the following. Having done this Fourier transformation, there is a remarkable simplicity that e to the power of v1 and e to the power of v2 is product over k. In particular, product over half of the Brillouin zone. That is, you notice that this term is diagonal index k. This connects k with a minus k. So you say that these are all two time reverse state. One is going in this direction, other is going in the other direction. They are connected. And this is again diagonal. So somehow, this tells me I can focus on the subspace of k and minus k and treat that. So in other words, I can keep it together and restrict this summation to k, which is positive. Because by this definition, if I take a k, already I have taken care of minus k. So I can treat this pair as one site in momentum space. And then further simplification comes. If I look at the detailed processes, this does not, OK, now what are the occupancy in this particular state? I can have zero fermions in both sides, or I can have fermion 1, 1, or 1, 0, or 0, 1. So these are all the possible states in a given pair, k minus k. So a k has a fermionic mode, minus k has a fermionic mode. I can have occupancy 0 or 1, or I can have occupancy. So there are, it generates 2 times 2, 4 states. And what is interesting is this is diagonal in this basis. This is also diagonal. Whereas this is off diagonal. What it does is, for example, it can act on this state and convert it into this state, which contains one fermion in each mode. Or you can take from here to here. So the off diagonal term in my Hamiltonian essentially connects only these two states, so-called even particle sector. So here the particle sector is 0 or 2, whereas the odd particle sector is not touched by this. Because if I go here, this state, and act with this, it will annihilate it. Because already there is a fermion, so I cannot put one more fermion. Similarly, this also will annihilate it. Because there are no fermions to take out. So something nice happens. The four-dimensional Hilbert space for a given k minus k prime. So I sum over all such k. This operator becomes block diagonal. So because if I look at this operator, for a given k value, its Hilbert space is four-dimensional. Fock space is four-dimensional. And now I observe that it becomes block diagonal. OK. So I'm doing all these things because I wanted to this is like normal mode decomposition, because when I started here spin, I cannot do normal mode decomposition, because if you do Fourier transformation, the tau q's and tau z q's, z and x, they don't commute. They have very complicated commutation relations. So I carefully follow this step. Now what I have done is I have achieved a normal mode decomposition in which I have fermionic normal modes in this system, not bosonic. This is something remarkable. Through the Jordan-Wigner transformation, I have done some trick, and my normal modes are fermionic modes. And why I call them as normal modes, because these operators commute for different k. Because I take a k minus k, and k prime minus k prime, there is no commutation. I have so organized the thing that the fermions anti-commute. This is something very important. Similarly, whereas that is not true if I had started with Fourier transformation of this tau chi x. You can show for yourself that these objects are very complicated, that the right-hand side is non-trivial. So that means a natural normal mode of this quantum spin chain are somehow fermions rather than bosons. This is something remarkable. So this is, you know, and what is interesting is you see this in a classical statistical mechanical problem. Because what Ansagan tried was to rewrite the classical statistical mechanics problem as evaluation of largest eigenvalue of a big matrix. And then nothing prevents Lipschultz and Mattis to use known tricks. And then at the end of the day, you have normal modes which are fermions. So this is just a mathematical consequence. But the fact is, this allows us to solve the problem. Now, as I said, since at k and k prime things commute, I can essentially focus on this operator for a given value of k. So let me call that as Vn of k. And solve the problem in a k minus k subspace. And this is again, it turns out it's very simple. OK, I will do that now, which was what done by. So I have e to the power of v1k. As I pointed out, that this acts, its states correspond to 1, 1, 0, 0. Now, if I look at the matrix element of this operator in this subspace, by construction, it is 1. Because if I have, let's see, this will annihilate that. So I'm just left with number operator. So for example, here, one of the fermion will be 0, another will be 1. So I get 0. So e to the power of 0. Similarly, I can organize this also to have a minus 1 sign from the beginning. So I should be careful here. That is, I collect all terms that has the k operator and minus k operator. And then, so here also I should collect if you do it correctly, what you will find is in that subspace of odd fermion, this entire matrix is trivial and 1. So it basically gives a constant factor which you can fill out. Because the whole, what I have achieved is to rewrite a complicated 2 to the power of m dimensional matrix as simple direct product in which things commute. So in real space, they did not commute. But in the k minus k space, they beautifully commute. And in particular, evaluating the largest eigenvalue amounts to solving a 4 by 4 matrix problem for a given k minus k. And there too, there is again a final simplification that it is block diagonal. There is no communication between this and this. So these two are connected by V1K, but whereas these are all not connected. So all this amounts to saying that mathematically, now I can do the following. I can now again think about another pseudo-spin operator. Incidentally, in condensed matter physics and in many model systems, whenever you deal with two-level system, that is two states, you can always write down operator that connect these two states in terms of pseudo-spins, which is what we have been doing. We started with Ising variables, and then in the transfer matrix approach, we got 2x2 matrix. We said that it connects, it becomes a pseudo-spin which connects up and down spin. In the same way, now we can define pseudo-spin in momentum space, because previously we had the site index. Now I have momentum index. And then when you do that, you get this, just copy it from my. Okay, when you do that, you get a very simple thing that, so this becomes, yes? They don't commute. So I'm going to keep track of them. Fortunately, both of them are 4x4 matrices. So I can take care of that, which is what I will show. No, 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 no. So what, see, it's important that what I'm saying is there is a k here and then k here. This k stands for k minus k. Now, you give me any other k, they commute. I can take these two operators for difference and then push it through. We can discuss it later. Yeah, this is exact. What you find is, I will define what are these. So if you want, I can put an index k here. So now I define a new pseudo spin, which takes me, let's say, between this and this. So these are all the two states. So I can define an operator which, and in particular, this operator takes me with an I factor from one to another, which we identify with sigma y. Because you remember sigma y, if you go back to the definition, is equal to 0 minus I. So it's off diagonal, so it will take one state to another state. And sigma z, it basically counts. It can be plus or one, minus one, so it's diagonal. So it becomes, that is, this number operator combination here and here simply becomes sigma z. So now we have an operator which contains sigma z, sigma y, and sigma, this two. Now we want to diagonalize this problem. You remember now the state it's acting on it just here. So it's a two-dimensional vector space. With these constants. Now we can play the several tricks. They don't commute, but you can use this Baker-Hausdorff, this formula that I alluded to before, E times E. And so on, or do a brute force solving this problem. Because it's eventually 2x2, I now claim, without loss of generality, that this can be written as e to the power of some a plus b z sigma z. There are many ways of seeing this. Suppose I expand this exponent here. Then I will have powers of these factors. But I know that sigma z or sigma x a sigma wave to the power of m equal to sigma z if m is odd, it's 1 if m is even. So that great simplification is there. Right? Similarly, for sigma y. So, and when sometimes I may get a term which looks like sigma x, sigma z, and sigma y. This by Pauli spin algebra is related to sigma x. So the most general combination that I will get after I expand it out cannot be anything other than this. Let me put also d sigma y. So this follows from the fact that sigmas have this very simple, nice property. Okay. Now suppose I get this. Then I can do another trick. I can rotate my operators in the spin space and in such a way that I define a new z axis, and this becomes basically e to the power of some a prime plus b prime sigma z. Because I have Pauli spin operators, all these things can be done. First, I have some non-commuting things. I organize it in such a way it has this most general form. So it looks like a spin. So this looks like a Hamiltonian in which there is a spin seeing a magnetic field which has component in the z direction, x direction, and y direction. Now I choose a new direction which is defined by this coefficient which I call as the z direction. So now if I do this, then I have solved what I wanted. Basically, then the largest eigenvalue will correspond to e to the power of a prime plus b prime. Assuming you can show that b is positive, then the next eigenvalue will be a prime minus b prime, because there are the two eigenvalues of the sigma z operator. So this is what effectively Lipschultz and Matisse do. So they start with this spin operators, quantum spin chain. In real space, there they don't commute. Even if you do Fourier transformation, you don't decompose it in normal modes. So they do this Jordan-Wigner trick. Then they get it in terms of fermions, which are bilinear. So whenever you have bilinear fermions or bosons, it is essentially a non-interacting problem. Because once you have, you can do this trick, and then things decompose in momentum space. This e to the power of v is in various k minus k moment, they commute. So I can focus on 1 k minus k, which is this. And within that, then there again, I have another luxury that this odd fermion sector decouples. I have only like a block diagonal. So and in particular, this is trivial in this sector. And here you have non-trivial off-diagonal elements, which I formally, as an operator, I write like this by identifying transition between these two states in terms of sigma x, sigma y, then I have this diagonal operator. Now I say that this is what you can rewrite it further and make them push through, that is, you write it e to the power of a plus b plus this, then do one more transformation, make it look like exponential of a Hamiltonian, which is just feeling some free spin. And the eigenvalue of this problem is very simple. Sigma z plus 1 is the largest eigenvalue. Sigma minus 1 is the lowest eigenvalue. Now, I will have an index k here, and I will have an index k here. So what Lipschultz and Matisse do is, after doing this algebra carefully, they get the explicit form. So if you look at the book by Huang, Statistical Mechanics, after about 20 pages, he basically gets this A case and B case following on Sagar. And if you look at the paper by Lipschultz and Matisse, it's a very famous paper. If you do Google, you will immediately get it. I think it's in Reviews of Modern Physics or Physical Review. You get this in few steps. And this is discussed in the book by Matisse. So the trick is to convert bosons into, or I keep calling this taus as bosons because, I do not know if I ever mentioned before, you can imagine the vacuum of, you know, a ferromagnetic state, for example, in which all spins are up, as a bosons in which the occupancy of the boson is zero. Then if one spin is down, you can call it as having one boson. So in other words, you think about this two-dimensional Hilbert space as a boson which can have occupancy 0 or 1. So that is called a hardcore boson. So in that sense, this operator tau plus is like a creation operator, and tau minus is an annihilation operator. But we have to keep in mind that you cannot keep adding more bosons at a given site. So they are called hardcore bosons. So what Lipschultz matrix achieved was to convert the hardcore bosons into fermions, and fermions have hardcore by its construction in terms of Pauli principle. You cannot have two fermions at a given site. And then there is a beautiful normal mode decomposition. That is, all operators in k minus k are, they come in a very nice form, and different k and k primes commute. So enough if I focus on one of that. And there again, there is a simplification. The odd sectors drop out from the problem. I have just even sector, 0, 0. And in that subspace, I can rewrite my fermion operator, again in terms of some effective Pauli spin operator for that k minus k. And then there, I follow Cayley-Hamilton theorem or whatever it be, the simple statement that when you have exponential of Pauli spin operators like this, they have to have this general form, nothing else. This is the most it's like a complete description. Then I get this coefficient, and then I do a rotation, I get this. Now I will write down the result that Lipschultz matrix got.
Did you just write that, like, you calculated the like, you use two exponential by brute force?
Sorry? Exactly, you can do that, yeah. Lipschultz and matrix, they do in a more elegant fashion, but I will not go into the algebra. But what is important for me is that, so now I'll write down the final result. Pardon me for, you know, not giving all algebraic details, but I have given you the steps, key steps in their thing, I have told you a couple of times. So what you find is the following. You find that A looks like I have this, and which depends on K and in particular the expression for epsilon k. Why am I writing like this? Because in this language, it starts looking like e to the power of my some e k, which depends on j, of some occupancy k. So in other words, when I solve this problem, this operator in k minus k becomes an operator of a Fermi mode, which can have which can have occupancy 1 or 0. So when the occupancy is 1 or when it is 0, it's the eigenvalue that we are looking for. Then I simply, the final result is product over e to the power of epsilon k, which is equal to e to the power of. So finding the largest eigenvalue amounts to finding some excitation energy. It looks like some excitation energy. Because when I exponentiate this, it has this form. It looks as if there is a fermionic mode, which can have occupancy 0 or 1. And then this is a corresponding energy. Now the expression for this energy is, as usual, you know, it involves all this cos hyperbolic and so on. sweep. So there is some constant term which depends on theta and j, the only two parameters we had in our matrix. Here there is theta and here there is j. And then, you know, because of whatever we do, we end up with this, and finally you have a cosine k coming from the cosine k that we had there. So if this is the case, then the final result is straightforward. I will write the final result for you.
Related to
exponential
of e to j times.
I did not show that. I'm saying that finally, because you now, as we have done it several times before, whenever you have an exponential operator, you can bring the operator down or go up. Finally, you will get this cost form. So I'm not going through the algebra, but this is the final result. Even more for the final result for the free energy, because once I have this epsilon k, and then I sum over k. This is my free energy because I take the partition function and log, which will give me this. So the expression for that, let me write down. Add it somewhere. Please give me 1 minute. I will.
Yeah.
It's a long formula, but since we will. I will explicitly write it here. So the free energy per site coming back to our, you know, kT and so on, putting kT and j separately, log of 2j by kT plus pi. So this is where this, you remember, I said that there is an exponential of k, I have summation over k. This k is defined over positive values of k, because I identified k and minus k and treated as one k value. So I have only positive value. So when you can go into momentum space, you have this, and then you convert it into an integral, because it's like integrating over the Brillouin zone, saying that the lattice parameter is 1. So instead of pi by 2a, I have pi by 2, and then you have this complicated thing. If you find, look at Onsager's solution, this is how it will look like. 1 minus k square pi half . So this is a famous Onsager solution. What I have achieved, I have just obtained the eigenvalues. That eigenvalues, when I write it in a neat analytic form, it becomes logarithm of some complicated thing. And the k, which I had, an integration from 0 to pi by 2, has become like an angular integral between 0 and pi by 2. Because once I have a limited integral, I can always rewrite it. And the cosine k has become some sine square of some angle phi. So this is Onsager's final expression. Now I'll have to say, what is this k? I'm sorry that I keep using this notation. This k is a complicated function. It's not the momentum. 2 sine hyperbolic k. And then further, OK, you can. You could rewrite this partition function and slightly simplify it in terms of this u variable, which already we came across before. U is so it turns out it is easy to expand this free energy in this new variable, which contains k and t, and then the critical point corresponds to u critical is given by that is start from this k variable and then go to this u variable and then rewrite this. But effectively, this k is a function of j by kt. That the way that it's appearing here. As you tune for a given J value temperature, when this K becomes 1, there's a critical point, as you can imagine. Because otherwise, there is nothing special about this function. There is something special about when this K becomes 1, because it becomes 1 minus sine square, which becomes cos square, and so on. So crudely, you can locate it. And if you look at this equation for K equal to 1, it defines the Ansagar's critical point. Okay. So this is the derivation. I'm sorry, I was too ambitious. I thought I will be able to do two algebra for Lipschultz and Matisse, but I have not been able to do that. But I have given you the key steps, basically normal mode decomposition in terms of fermionic variable. Then in terms of fermionic variable, again, there is an off-diagonal character, because these fermions, unlike our standard fermions, do not just hop. They spontaneously appear and disappear. So we control that doing some rotation, which technically will be called Bogoliubov rotation. In fact, if you go back to theory of fermions having this general bilinear form, they can be diagonalized by Bogoliubov transformation, which is what we did effectively when we rotated in that spin basis and brought it to a manageable Hamiltonian, which contains only Z component of spin operator. OK. So this is about Ansagar solution. As I said, Huang gives full description of Ansagar solution. You can also go to Ansagar's original paper. Then Lipschultz Matisse gives a much more simplified way in which you arrive at the same result. Then you can proceed along this line and get the famous result that Ansagar got, namely magnetization. That is, if you sit at critical point, T equal to TC, you sit at the critical point and ask the question, how magnetization varies with magnetic field? It's supposed to vary. Then Ansagar got the right number. In fact, there is a small story behind it. Ansagar is supposed to have announced this result. He did not, this result was not there in his paper. In a meeting somewhere in Italy, he said that this is the result for magnetization, and this delta, the number is like 15. But he did not give the derivation, and then nobody asked him. Then it was Li and Yang who later proved this analytically, going beyond what Ansagar did, and got this. It's a very famous work by Li and Yang. Now, using Schultz Li Matisse method, you can also get this very easily. Then you can infer all the critical. So another thing I should have mentioned, that if you look at you can ask the question, what is the critical, what is the singularity contained in this free energy? At the end of the day, the singularity contained here is U minus UC square log of U minus EC. So the entire search for singularity and phase transition can be gotten just from here. So this is a free energy, singular part of the free energy. If you take derivative with respect to U, which is related to T, this disappear and you get log, which is the famous logarithmic singularity of Ansagar. Okay. Yes.
How can we know how the magnetization
responds to it? So the question is, without putting magnetic field, how am I able to, because Ansagar did not solve the magnetic field, but how he still managed to get it. So this is related to looking at spin-spin coordinate. Okay, this is the very thing. I'm glad you asked this question. Let me. So the question is the following. Suppose I have no information, I have not applied any symmetry breaking magnetic field. Then I go below TC, transition temperature, and still I want to insist, I want to get order parameter. The following thing will work. Take spin at a site I. Let me take. Calculate this. So while an individual spin thermal expectation value is 0, or you take any site, because even in an ordered state, because you have not applied any magnetic field, So when you sum over configurations, you'll have configurations in which spins are all up, spins are all down. They will all contribute, and you will have this just by definition, it is 0. However, Onsager and others pointed out that, however, if you look at two spin correlation function, this will give you the order parameter looking for time square. In other words, as you do thermal averaging, if you are, let's say, well below TC, you will find configurations like this. And identical configurations like this with just spin reversed, contributing to the partition function. Now, so this also contributes, this also contributes. There is something common here. If I take the spin correlation function, if both are up, I will get some value. And there are fluctuations, so that will lead to reduction. So whether I have this configuration or configurations like this, I will get identical number on the right hand side. So without introducing any symmetry breaking field, in principle, if you can calculate long range spin correlation, that is limit r goes to z infinity, this correlation function will give you the order parameter that is hiding in this particular thermal state. Whereas if you apply a small symmetry breaking field, immediately it will prefer this and kill this, for example. Or if you apply opposite side, it will kill this and you have this. So unfortunately, you cannot solve Onsager's problem, Ising model problem, with symmetry breaking field. So there is this trick, so which is looking at spin correlation function. And this gives you, by definition, you know, in other words, it is as if it gets mathematically, it amounts saying that this correlation function factors into a piece which is obtained by putting a symmetry breaking field and making it vanish, similarly another piece. So this is a manner of speaking, but what I'm saying is basically it will give you, so this can be non-zero. What it means is, if you look at that is, you have some 2 to the power of n dimensional spin configuration phase. So you are averaging over everybody. So there is a region here which corresponds to ferromagnetic when you spin solve point. There is an equivalent region which is here. So when you blindly sum over everybody, you will get 0 value for an individual spin. But however, this region and this region look identical as far as this quantity is concerned. And that brings out the hidden order in the system. Yeah, this is how Onsager solved it. So he was not able to apply a magnetic field, but however, he was able to get some information about spin correlation function and then look at its large value. OK. Now, in the rest of the 10 minutes, I will tell you about this remarkable thing that is hiding here, namely conformal symmetry. This was, I think, historically discovered by Pokrovsky and Potashinsky, and then later brought in a big way by Belavin, Polyakov, and Zomolodchikov. So the idea is the following. If you look at the scaling that Vaidam talked about, basically you say that you change the length scale and the system should look similar as you approach a critical point. And Kadanoff implemented it in the block spin hypothesis. But it turns out, in the Onsager problem, in addition to this very simple dilatation or scaling, there are infinite number of deformations you can do, which preserves the shapes of the correlation function at the critical point. And this is something remarkable, and that is related to conformal transformation. So whatever I did amounts to saying that I start with a lattice then I do coarse graining, then I have a slightly bigger lattice. So the physics in both lattice looks identical. This is what was the motivation, and it looks as if that's what is happening. But what is remarkable is, turns out, so for example, how will I see this? So I come here and take a good lens and then look at it. Then at short scale, whatever is happening here is happening here. In particular, if I look at dominant configurations of spins that contribute to my free energy, they look so disordered. Whatever length scale I look, they look the same. But is it just that, or there are more things? It turns out there are more things than meets the eye. For example, you could imagine rotating the lattice, which is trivial, or translating the lattice, which is also trivial. But imagine you distort the lattice locally in different fashions. That is, you, in other words, suppose I have a lens, big lens, which has lots of aberrations. So in some region in the lens, it's like a concave mirror. In some region, it is a convex mirror. Let's assume it's possible to imagine such a mirror. Now I look at a dominant configuration. Whether you look with a very simple, not a mirror, lens, whether you look at with a simple lens or a lens full of aberrations, you cannot distinguish the configuration that you see from the original one statistically. So this is remarkable. In other words, you could imagine a transformation in which some regions are dilated, some regions are expanded, and still the pattern of spin configurations will look identical. This is a consequence of, you know, after analyzing Ansager's sizing models and so on, and there are mathematical proofs for that, but I will give a very simple heuristic proof why it should be so. So if you, okay, now in your field theory course, and you must have learned about conformal thing that, what are conformal transformations? That is, let me think about a continuum. I have volume element dx times dy. Then I can write it as x plus iy, that is a local coordinate, in terms of x minus y. Anticipating lots of insights from complex variable theory, instead of x and y, I will use z. Now, conformal transformations are transformations in which z goes to f of z, and z prime goes to some f prime of z, which preserves some property of this, that is, under this transformation, this go to some So, for example, if you start with the general metric, after the conformal transformation, you will get back the matrix times some function of local coordinates. So this automatically happens. And more importantly, what you get here, that this decomposition takes place whenever you have any analytic function f of z, which is what you learn in complex variable theory as conformal transformations, that preserves angles. For example, I choose an f in which my lattice gets curved like this globally. So what I preserve is this angle here at 90 degree. I can do it, for example, by taking a function f of z, which is equal to z square. Or I can choose e to the power of z. So there are places where it won't be conformal. But most of the region, you can give a power series expansion, and it looks like, you know, analytic. And what is remarkable is you can do all those general distortions of the lattice as you like, and then the resulting spin configuration of the very dominant spin configuration started with cannot be distinguished statistically from what you had before. Why does this happen? The way I understand it, I have not seen it elsewhere discussed, is the following, which is related to just looking at spin configuration in terms of domain walls. Remember, I said that you start with a configuration like this. There was an argument due to Pyle's how to disorder. For example, you can imagine a situation in which spins are so disorder appears through appearance of closed curves. And it will cost some energy. So the statistical factor that you will have u to the power of minus 2 times j times length of this curve in steps of lattice parameter. Now, this is the probability with which such domain walls can appear. Now, as you heat the system from zero temperature, here and there domain walls will pop up. Then as you approach the transition temperature, they will grow in size, and they will coalesce, and they will fill the space. Now, what is interesting is that if you take focus on one such domain wall and keep seeing how it grows into some very complicated fractional pattern at the critical point, to the extent that if the size of this is L, let me say some, what is the number? Okay, I have been using L too many times. Okay, if this is L, then the number of points inside, if it were a regular curve like this, it will be proportional to L square. Now, there will be some correction to it. Let me call it as some mu. So this is called a fractal dimension. That is, the domain walls which proliferate are no more regular objects. They look distorted. So if you take such dominant domain wall and distort it in any way you like, you can always find such a configuration elsewhere in the system. So in that sense, they become self-similar. Not just scaling. That is, it is true that if you look at the domain wall from a distance, you'll find bigger fellows coming and looking similar. That is true. That's simple scaling, just one parameter scaling, length scaling. But what conformal invariant says is, take this and twist this as you like, and scale this down and scale this up, you get a domain wall configuration. The statement is, you'll find such a configuration elsewhere in the system with very high probability. So it's like in group theory, that is, you do this transformation, become something else which is already available, so you can keep going in between. So the wonder in 2 plus 1 dimension is, you start with one symmetry, namely dilation or scaling symmetry, and then got some insight. And finally, you end up at a critical state which has hidden inside it infinite number of symmetries. They are the conformal symmetries. And that's a big subject. You will be learning more and about it in terms of Virasoro algebra and so on. But the point is, it's hidden in this very simple heuristic picture that we started with to show the existence of phase transition. So the elementary objects were domain walls. And these domain walls grow in size and shape. And at the critical point, they fill up space. So you imagine any shape gotten from this one I give you. That is, I stretch it, here in an inhomogeneous, space-dependent way, I get some configuration. And the statement is, because it's a critical state, you will find such configurations elsewhere also. So under this conformal transformation, they go into each other. So that's a symmetry. It's all because the underlying object is some extended object. Now you can take this picture to higher dimension. So in fact, this is a big question whether such things are implied when you go to three-dimensional Ising model. The conjecture and many intuitive pictures say that probably it should. The answer is, if you follow my argument, it will follow, because when I go to three-dimension, instead of domain walls, this you can call it as a domain line. So it separates down spins from up spins. Then you will have domain wall, closed domain walls. Now, at the critical point, they will have very odd shape. Something will be protruding here, something will be going long, and there will be like a membrane which is becoming rough and rough and rough. Now, nothing prevents me from saying that if I sit at the critical point, I take one of those huge one and then distort that without violating some rule. It's very important that when I do this, I don't make this cross. That is, at no point this domain wall should cross itself on the lattice level. They should avoid. They can go through each other. For example, I can have something like this. This is a permissible thing, for example. All spins up, out, down, down. So this is consistent. So downspin and upspin, downspin, upspin. So this is like two domain walls sitting on top of each other. And they can grow independently. OK, so when you go to three-dimensional Ising model, you will have surfaces, which again, probably you can use this kind of heuristic argument to show that that also will be conformal. But there is no rigorous proof for it. So in a very intuitive fashion, this is the end result. The end result is, if you think in terms of spin configuration, of course, as given in pictures, it looks random and scale-free. But if you look inside, the spin configurations associated with them are these kind of domains. And if you focus on an individual domain, it grows in size and shape and takes such an irregular shape that you can deform it in any way you like. You'll always find similar things somewhere else. I think with that note, I will close. So let me say what I have done today. So I went back to the two-dimensional Ising model that we started some classes back and said the important thing is to look at the transfer matrix, which cannot be handled to get the largest eigenvalue. So do basically two things. One is do John-Arp-Wigner transformation. Then it automatically gives you normal mode decomposition in momentum space, in the sense these modes don't talk to each other at different momenta, k and k prime. So it's a normal mode decomposition. But surprisingly, in terms of this is in terms of fermions. So when you study lattice dynamics, you know, you have normal mode decomposition in terms of phonons, which are bosonic variables. Here, they are in terms of fermionic variables. Normally, it happens in a Fermi system, like in a superconductor. When you have attractive interaction, you get normal mode decomposition in terms of Bogoliubov quasi-particles. Here, it beautifully happens. And then you are forced, then the problem reduces to solving a 4x4 matrix, largest eigenvalue of some 4x4 matrix. There is a further reduction, becomes a 2x2 matrix. There is a further reduction. And then finally, you get this form that Ansager got with a lot of labor and pain. And then I pointed out, about this, how do you get magnetization within this formalism without applying external magnetic field? That amounts to taking two spin correlation function and then taking them to large distance. Then you will not get average value of m, you will get m square. So average value of m is zero, but you will get m square average in some sense. Then I pointed out that this is a later finding after Ansager and after Kadanoff and others, that in addition to the scaling symmetry that you focused on, namely just length scale change, that the physics doesn't change, there is a rich symmetry behind, namely, particularly in two dimension, a conformal symmetry, which is infinite dimensional in two dimension. And that turns out to be related to, as I argue, related to the pattern of disorder. Disorder can be viewed as creation of domain walls. And at very low temperature, these domain walls are small and roughly, you know, simple shape. As you reach a critical point, they grow in size and shape. So they get any irregular shape that you can imagine. And once you have that, you can deform among themselves. That corresponds to local change, local dilation, local expansion, and translation, rotation, and so on. So you remain within the states that are generated by dominant configuration. So that is a heuristic explanation for conformal invariance emerging here. So I would have liked to do kinetics. It's a very important aspect of statistical mechanics. That is, when you start with equilibrium statistical mechanics, you can perturb it gently and get lots of information about what you measure experimentally, things like resistivity, viscosity, and many transport properties, and many other properties. And that, you know, fluctuation dissipation theorems, unfortunately, there is no time. So I will leave it there. And okay, this is where I will stop. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. And wish you all the best and in your career. Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to. By the way, I'm here for the next 10 days. I sit in room number 374. So if you have any questions, please drop by. I believe that next week is our break week, and you will be tested on statistical mechanics. So good luck. Yeah, somebody had a- Okay, there are no questions, thank you.